You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Again, he never got to an interview with anybody else. Like we're analyzing the Falcons process, but it's only because it's the only process to look at. And I think that the one that surprised me the most, I think, looking back on it, was Washington.
Hey there, boys and girls. Welcome to another edition of The Business of Sports with Andrew Brandt. We're presented, as always, by DraftKings, produced by Jack Connell, musical producer Sam Brandt, my son. That's the music you hear under us. Special, special podcast today. Coming up in a few minutes, I have Don Van Natta and Seth Wickersham. They're the eminent writers for ESPN and ESPN.com. Respected journalists in every corner of the business, especially for their NFL work, and especially in Seth's case, his work with Belichick and Brady and Kraft and the New England Patriots. A big story this week on ESPN.com about Bill Belichick not getting a job in this hiring cycle after being relieved of his duties with the Patriots. They had their parting ways after so many years. He didn't get a job. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about the reports in the reporting of them about the Falcons having him listed not even in the top three, about other situations, not getting a job. I think it's announced he'll work the draft in a couple weeks, and we don't know after that. Anyway, we'll talk to Seth and Don in a minute. I want to give you a couple of my Brant's rants before we get to them. And it's really going to be all about the woman we keep talking about, because from a business of sports angle, we've probably never seen anything like this. Certainly since I've been doing the podcast for the last 6 years, nothing like Caitlin Clark. And by that, I mean lifting an entire sport to heights they've never seen. Think about that. LeBron didn't do that. Michael Jordan didn't do that. Wayne Gretzky didn't do that. Now, of course, they lifted their sports, of course, but from where the sport was to where it went is not as big a gap as what we're seeing right now with pre-Caitlin Clark and post-Caitlin Clark. I think there will be that dividing line in the sand for two different sports, women's college basketball and the WNBA. There will be a line in the sand between pre-Caitlin Clark and post-Caitlin Clark. I think women's college basketball will suffer greatly compared to how it ended this past year. That's not saying women's college basketball won't be popular. It won't be the mega popular thing that it was this past month, primarily due to Caitlin Clark. And people can say there are other stars. Of course there are other stars. Of course there are. I saw Paige Beckers play at Villanova. She's a star. I love seeing her. I'm going to go see her next year. But that's a one-off, right? Caitlin Clark is putting it at a whole different level, and those ratings, oh my God. Let's put in perspective that final between South Carolina and Iowa drew 18 million average. That was twice what the Masters rating for Sunday's final was. Twice. Think about that. Women's college basketball, twice the rating of the last day of the Masters. Again, we're in a business of stars, and for whatever reason, she has become a megastar. We can debate it. That's more for a sociological discussion, whether it has to do with race, whether it has to do with sort of this Midwestern wholesomeness. Of course, it's due to her logo threes, her incredible shooting range, the fact that she launches these three-pointers that go in so often. That's part of it. That's not all of it. There's something that is attached to America about this woman. And no, it's not women's college basketball in general. Sure, it's gotten a boost, but it's her. And now we'll see it in the WNBA. So a couple numbers come out this week. Number one, their draft, $2.45 million viewers for their draft, which usually draws a few hundred thousand. Last year was $500,000. They get 5 times that amount this year. Okay, you tell me, what's the difference? It's her. And the most watched draft in history with Diana Taurasi some 15 years ago or whatever it was, 600,000. She drew almost 2.5 million. And it is, it's her. Indiana Fever, oh my God. 36 of 40 games on national TV. And my reaction, as I told you last week, was what about the other four? Oh, we crave it. We, this country, craves the Indiana Fever games. Her jersey, which is now sold out, you can't even get. Highest selling rookie jersey ever after a draft. Beat Trevor Lawrence in 2021 with the Jaguars. The numbers just, they keep pouring out about this woman. And then the Nike deal, whatever it is, $20 million. It's just a constant. And I don't even want to have the argument anymore about, well, if she stayed in college. Stayed in college, why? Why? I think people want her to stay in college because they prefer watching college basketball than WNBA, but it's her. You're going to watch her. Listen, why do you care? I mean, why would people care that she stay at Iowa? I mean, beyond all the money, she wants to play against the best players in the world. I don't understand that argument. Because NIL is gone. It's now pay for play. And yeah, were they going to pay her millions of dollars? These endorsements? Yeah, I guess. But not like she can get in the pros. And not like she can get the competition she's going to get in the pros. Do we hear this much cavorting about Angel Reese going to the pros and not staying at LSU? I don't understand. Anyway, that argument continues to befuddle me. Okay, the Caitlin Clark effect, it will be a line in the sand. I've never seen anything like it. The last thing I didn't even mention, these arenas. We've seen it a couple places now. Las Vegas going from one arena to the other one. One that holds a few thousand to one that holds 20,000. It just happened in D.C., so the Washington Mystics game, whenever they play there, that will go from where the Mystics play, which is, I don't know, 4,000 fans, to the Capital One Arena, where the Wizards and Capitals play, 20,000 fans, just for her. Just for her. Okay. It's just amazing, the Caitlin Clark effect. It is something we've never seen. Again, you can't tell me anyone's elevated a sport like that. Of course, Jordan and Gretzky and Tiger Woods made it a different level of interest. But from where it was to where it is now, in a month or in a year, I don't think we've seen that. Golf was very popular before Tiger Woods, of course. You know, so that's my point on that. All right, I want to get to our special guests. I've known these guys from working at ESPN, from being involved with them at ESPN, from covering the NFL, from my vantage point on the business side and their vantage point on the insider stuff that they are so great at. I want to, without further ado, bring on the podcast Don Van Natta and Seth Wickersham. What a pleasure it is to have two friends and colleagues that I've known so long and admired their work so long. Don Van Natta and Seth Wickersham are with me here on the pod to talk about this story that really broke a lot of news this week about Bill Belichick's exit and lack of entry into the NFL this year. And we're going to talk about it. Don, Seth, welcome to the pod. Great to have you.
Hey, great to be here.
Thanks, Andrew. Always great to be with you.
Yeah, Don, you're a many repeat customer, so I appreciate it. And good to
it's
have
my pleasure.
Your partner, Seth, who's always been someone I admired, and we've gotten along. And thanks for all your advice as I developed my writing career at ESPN back in the day. Okay.
Of course.
Well, I guess where I want to start this is sort of beyond the column, beyond the article. Are you guys surprised, looking back, now your reporting is going to maybe skew your answer, that Bill Belichick is not coaching in 2024?
I'll take it first. Yes and no. I think that obviously one of the reasons why we wanted to dig into the story and the reason why we did it is because, yeah, we are surprised and we're not alone. And that period went so fast.
Yes, from always does.
Departure from New England, the hiring and firing cycle commences, it looks like he's going to get the Falcons gig. That doesn't work. And all of a sudden the musical chairs have ended and that was the only look he got. And as we report, it was really, it was half a sincere look and half of a look just out of respect, like a cursory look. And it happened so fast. And in the NFL, as you know, we just move on so quickly. It's the Super Bowl. Then it's the free agency. Then it's, you know, the draft. And it's kind of like, wait a second. How did this happen? How could a guy with 8 Super Bowl rings, far more than anyone who is interviewing him or has been hired, end up without a job when he wanted one? And, you know, I think that those were the things that led us to look into it. And then when you zoom back from that, you wonder whether he's going to end up with a job next year at all. I mean, at the end of the day, Belichick is kind of a fixed quantity, right? I mean, we know who he is.
Right.
And he's incredibly adaptive within the game of football, but he is who he is. And this is really an ownership story in a story about the ways that owners perceive people, the way they make decisions, the way they hire people. And in that regard, Don and I felt like we're on really fertile ground because, you know, NFL governance is kind of our beat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Just to echo that, Andrew. Yeah, I was stunned by the fact that Belichick only got one look with 7 openings. You would think that a coach, as Seth said, with 8 Super Bowl rings and his resume, he would really have the pick of where he wanted to go. And the only place that was interested in him was Atlanta, you know, not a franchise that I think you can put in the same conversation as the Giants, the Cowboys, the Eagles, the old guard franchises that really appeal to Belichick. Belichick's sense of history is so profound.
Yeah.
And so for him to end up in Atlanta, and, you know, the joke, you know, when he first had that first meeting on Blank's super yacht, and as we reported for the first time, you know, moored in Antigua,
yeah,
just the two of them on January 15th, the joke was that it wasn't the Falcons interviewing Belichick. It was Belichick interviewing the Falcons,
right?
I mean, that's what we all thought. We thought this is a done deal. And just 4 days later, he gets that second look, and we just assumed that it was his job. And he was as stunned. What one of the things I thought from our reporting that emerged that surprised me, Andrew, is that Belichick, the morning that Raheem Morris gets the job, just a few hours before it's announced on January 25th, Bill Belichick thinks the job is his. And, you know, we led the story with that. And again, so he was as surprised as all of us, I thought was also a really interesting fact in this whole process.
You know, I want to get into all the teams, especially the Falcons. I guess I'm looking at this maybe a little different. It just seems to me, having been around the league, a lot of these teams, they want to build cultures. They want to build for the future. They want sustained success. So maybe I'm a little bit in the minority. I wasn't shocked he didn't get a job because I think it's easy to say he's Bill Belichick, but it's also easy for these teams and leadership to say, we want to build. A lot of these teams are bad teams, which means they're going to be young teams and they're going to build up and they want a coach there for 3, 5, 6, 10, 15 years. Pete Carroll didn't get a job. Mike Vrabel didn't get a job. I mean, is there a reasonable answer to the question, which does not have to do with Belichick's not this or Belichick wanted too much control or Belichick other things? And I guess I'm asking in a sort of a nice way, is there some kind of ageism going on here?
I think so. Belichick just this week turned 72.
Yeah.
And as our reporting showed, you know, Belichick is the system. You know, he's been in the system in New England for the majority of 24 years. He's that strong general manager slash head coach. Accountability is so important to him. And our reporting shows, talking to people around the league, that that is no longer the premium. That's no longer the gold standard. Cooperation and collaboration are the new sort of coin of the realm with owners. And so I think that that in itself hurts Belichick, certainly hurt him in January and could hurt him again next offseason. Right, Seth, I think that's one of the big takeaways of what a report
is. It is, and it's interesting because what culture do they want? And what does that actually mean? So I've written a book about the Patriots. I think it's over your right shoulder there.
Yes.
And, you know, the title itself gives you a sense of that culture. And there are some pros and cons of that. I mean, we've seen multiple players come out over the years and, you know, when they're out of the system, speak about how, you know, it can be an emotionless pursuit of victory, you know, based on fear and leverage and, you know, but they won six Super Bowls.
Yeah.
I mean, Belichick for two decades, it kind of had two different runs, but for two decades, you know, his family, his tree was the tree in the NFL. It was just like Bill Walsh's in the late 80s, early 90s, kind of what happened with Holmgren and Green Bay, as you know. I mean, those guys all got their own gig. And, you know, Bill essentially had two runs at that. And those guys didn't do very well on their own by and large. Like, there are some exceptions, like Dimitroff, obviously in Atlanta.
Right.
I think he was an excellent GM for most of his run. But a lot of these guys, Josh McDaniels is invaluable within the Belichick ecosystem and can't last 2 years on his own in any other running another team. And that's ended. Like, the past couple years have been a massive repudiation of the Patriot way, as they say. And what teams want are coaches from the McVay tree and the Shanahan tree, and they want those minds. And that gets into culture too, because those are hard places to work. Like, those are not easy places. They are collaborative sometimes, and other times, you know, they're dictatorships. And so, like, I can't tell what owners want at this point, because in my opinion, if you're Washington and you need to get a stadium built in DC and get that team on track, who's better at taking a talented roster and turning them into a team than Bill Belichick? And he'd hand it off to whoever. They'd have a stadium being built. They'd be in good cap shape, whatever it might be. If you're Jerry Jones and it's obvious that you've plateaued at a high level, but not the highest level under Mike McCarthy. Like, again, he's in win now mode for obvious reasons. Now, why wouldn't you want Belichick to come in and provide a jolt to that team and get an incredibly good roster performing at the highest level? We can analyze Atlanta's decision, but at the end of the day, they're the only ones who actually gave him a look. The other ones kind of moved on quickly. And that, to me, is really mysterious and revealing about what owners want, or more specifically, what they don't want.
You know, it's interesting. I don't want to let it slip that you talked about the Belichick tree not doing so well. Enlighten me a little more. There was a line in your article about Belichick answering a question about that, correct?
Mm-hmm.
It's something about some people are meant to be soldiers and not lieutenants. Was that with the Falcons, or was that with someone else? It was.
He only interviewed with the Falcons.
Only interviewed there. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. It was so his first job interview. It was his first job, official job interview as a head coach in the NFL. To be a head coach in the NFL since he interviewed with the Raiders in 1998. That is that is an incredible statistic.
26. Right. And John Gruden got that job.
Yeah.
But that question, Andrew, you're right. It was about a couple of his assistants who, I think this is another drag on Belichick, is that some of his assistants, of course, have not done well as head coaches, as we know. And he was asked about that during his interview with the Falcons. And our reporting shows that he said that there's some folks that are better as soldiers than generals. And I think it's Belichick. My assessment when I heard that, and Seth, correct me if you think this is the wrong takeaway on it, is that it was Belichick's way of sort of bending as much as he could. He tried to assure the Falcons, I know we'll get into it, Andrew, but he tried to assure the Falcons that he was going to just coach. He didn't need that power. He was really, for Belichick, bending an extraordinary amount to get a job that, again, as I said earlier, is not, I think, one of the premier jobs that he would put on his list, like the Commander's job, the Eagles job, the Giants job. And because it was the only chance he had, he really was bending over backwards to say all the right things, make all the concessions he felt that were necessary to get the job, and yet still didn't finish in the top three. And that, for me, that's just extraordinary. And says a lot about, I think, where we are right now with what owners are looking at, what premium they're putting on leadership in the league. And so for Seth and I and the rest of our colleagues, that's why this story was so important. It's a moment that we can really take a measure of about where the NFL is headed.
And I agree with everything he said. And I think that staff was essential to him because they know how he works.
Yeah.
And he is not going to have to teach 19 new coaches or whatever it might be at his final stop. And it's also, I think, what gave teams pause, not only because some of these guys have damaged reputations because of how they've done on their own, but because there's a presumption out there that Bill's going to coach till he gets Don Shula's record, till he eclipses it. And then he'll retire whenever that might be, probably 2 years, whatever it might be. And then what do you do? Because Bill is such a presence that even if he's not demanding complete authority and autonomy, he's so well thought out, so detailed, so meticulous, and so studied that you almost have to defer to him. Even if he's saying, hey, I'll work with this person, I'm happy to work with that person, whatever it might be. And if he only does that for 2 years and you ice out people in the building or you let people go or whatever it might be, you remake the building in a Belichick mode and he goes, who do you hire from there? Because what do you do next? Because a lot of these guys haven't had great track records on their own. And so then you'd be starting over again in 2 years. And I know that Arthur Blank hates doing coaching searches. He doesn't turn over coaches very quickly. You know, he gives these guys a lot of time to prove whether they can do it. And, you know, they've generally the past 20 years, I mean, the Falcons have been at times a contender and at times not, but like, you know, he's someone who likes to give the people that he puts in charge enough rope and leeway to win or lose on their own terms. And, you know, the idea of starting over in 2 years again after Bill sets this record was unappealing to him.
And there is one other thing about Arthur Blank very quickly, Andrew, I want to make the point too. Arthur Blank also hates confrontation. He hates controversy. Right, Seth? I mean, we've seen that. We saw it when he was the chair of the compensation committee and Jerry Jones was making a big issue about Roger Goodell's mammoth salary. Arthur shut that down, didn't want any of that. And so that's also what was at risk here, is that despite Belichick assuring Arthur Blank that he was going to play nicely in the sandbox with those other executives, who, by the way, didn't want Belichick. And, you know, Rich McKay and Terry Fontenot, they fought against him. And that also was a major factor here, most likely, in why Blank chose not to go with Belichick. But that aversion to conflict, I think, was another factor with Arthur Blank, where he just said, okay, not only do I not like to change coaches too often, as Seth points out, but also I'm going to have conflict on my hand, which he hates. So I think that was another factor in why Arthur Blank decided to do what he did.
Yeah, Don, and you kind of answered my next question, which was about Blank. You talked about the super yacht meeting in Antigua. You can just picture Belichick showing up on the yacht, which seems to me like, okay, these two guys are bonding and that he's going to bring him back to the facility and he's going to hire him, you know, within days. But then it changed. It seems like exactly what you just talked about. Fontenot and McKay were saying all the things that Seth just talked about. We want to build. We don't want to be out here in 2 years doing this again. Although the Falcons, what did Arthur Smith last 2 years, 3 years? I mean, it wasn't a long run. So you would think he'd be kind of used to that and do it with someone that's got a sterling resume.
Yeah, you could argue that Arthur Smith lasted longer than probably he should have, that Blank might have stuck with him that extra season when he really hadn't done much. But yeah,
do you think those two guys, McKay and Fontenot, overruled Arthur Blank? We can talk about the Kraft conversation in a minute, but do you think they made that decision?
I don't know. What do you think, Seth? I think that they lobbied hard. And as I said earlier, I think that that was in the equation that Blank put together in deciding whether to go with Belichick or not, that he was going to potentially have a crisis on his hands if, despite Belichick's assurances that he was only interested in coaching. And if that didn't happen, I think Blank, you know, potentially saw the worst case scenario on the horizon. And that was something that kept him from doing it. But I don't think they had veto power. The decision was ultimately Arthur Blank's.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you, as you know, mostly, you know, but you worked in a unique situation for a lot of your career, but you know, nobody tells the owner what to do.
Like,
you know, they work in service of at his pleasure. And I think that it was, but it was clear. And I think that it felt like it was just too much for the Falcons to take on for what they anticipated could be a 2-year run. And it's interesting. Like, one of the most interesting things about the way that Belichick has run things is that, you know, the Patriots under Kraft and especially under Belichick, they were kind of, obviously they've had some falling outs in their relationship, but they were kindred spirits in this regard. They liked running a lean operation.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a lot of infrastructure in New England. Like, people don't realize like how much Belichick did and how much came out of his mind. And you've seen New England having to hire positions and extra coaches in areas where they didn't have to do that for 25 years because Bill just handled that. They didn't need to hire someone to do it because it was a 5-minute conversation and decision with Bill Belichick. And I think that how he would adapt to working to in a building where there are all those layers and there is all that infrastructure, I think that is one of the more kind of like interesting things going forward. Like, let's just say, for instance, that the Eagles have a bad year and that Jeffrey Lurie decides to move on and he and Roseman survives again and they decide to hire Bill. The Eagles are one of the most funded teams in the NFL. Like, they are on the cutting edge and they have staff for sports science. They have all kinds of things that they do not have in New England. And it's very different than what Belichick is used to working with. And I wonder how he'll fit into a ecosystem like that.
Well, it also seemed like, I'm sure he could have his pick of any assistants he wanted, and maybe the Krafts would fund that. But we've seen the past couple of years hiring assistants in weird positions like Matt Patricia and Joe Judge that didn't really fit, but they were, as you guys point out, his guys.
They were also getting paid by their former teams that they had been fired by.
Oh, that too. The offset language. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Which again, it pleases Robert Kraft, who likes that lean operation. Not just, by the way, with the New England Patriots, also the league office, as Seth and I've heard repeatedly, that Kraft thinks the league office is also too fat and is constantly talking about making cuts there. So yeah, lean operation is always something that Kraft has his eye on.
Well, that segues to this question about the remaining amount left on Bill Belichick's contract. You guys reported $25 million. Now, let's be clear, that was for this year or remaining compensation that may not be allocated towards this year, just whatever's left on the contract. Was he making $25 million a year, at least for this year?
Yeah, that's the amount that's been reported. And I believe it was for this coming year, $25 million. Yeah,
he last year signed a 2-year deal. The reported figure we stated as being reported in the story, but it was a 2-year deal, and he was, you know, he and the Patriots separated a year into that.
So whatever he made last year, obviously he got paid, and your reporting is that there was 25 left on the deal.
And yeah, we're reflecting the reporting on that.
And as offset goes, as we just talked about with other coaches, if he were hired anywhere, including Atlanta, that would come off the financial obligation of the Crafts, whatever he would be paid there. I assume that would be an offset contract. Is that what you guys know?
That's what I was told by a source that, and this was basically used as an explanation of why Robert Kraft would not necessarily be motivated
right.
to give a bad review or a bad reference to Arthur Blank, in that if in fact Arthur Blank hires Belichick, there's a lot less money that Robert Kraft will owe to him. So again, I want to make it clear that's the context of the information and the way it was presented. But I heard that only from one source. Seth, you may have it elsewhere, but that's the one source and that's the context in which that argument was made.
I think that if a team wanted Bill Belichick, the offset language would have been something that would have been easily navigated.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Absolutely.
So let's get to that report of a negative review. Can you talk a little bit more about that, Don? From Kraft?
Yeah. Our information is that there were two conversations that occurred in the window in which Bill Belichick was being considered by Arthur Blank to be the next head coach of the Falcons. And in at least one of those conversations, our sourcing, very solid sourcing that comes from both the Belichick side and the Kraft side, is that very specifically, Robert Kraft warned Arthur Blank that Bill Belichick is not somebody you can trust. And now we don't know from our reporting whether or not those words were the deal killer, if you will, or the reason why Arthur Blank chose not to hire him. I should tell you that Stacey James, the spokesman mm-hmm. for the Patriots, adamantly denies that these words were ever said by Robert Kraft to Blank in those two phone conversations that they had in January, those reference calls. Stacey insisted to us that, in fact, Robert Kraft advocated strongly for Bill Belichick with Arthur Blank. But the context for this is we have other reporting, people around this that were familiar with those conversations, who told us that there was some candor on the part of Robert Kraft and his conversations with Arthur Blank. There's no specifics about that, but that there's candor. We also know from our reporting that Arthur Blank and Robert Kraft are very, very close. They have a very close friendship. They talk all the time. And, you know, even Stacey James acknowledged that there was a chance, perhaps, that something negative was shared by Robert Kraft with Arthur Blank about Belichick prior to this window when Belichick was in line for the Falcons job. You know, it's fascinating because, of course, the backstory, the backdrop to this is also the Dynasty documentary, the 10-part Apple Plus series. And there's a lot of Patriots fans and even some former Patriots players that feel strongly that this Kraft-supported docuseries was quite unkind to Bill Belichick. So our reporting that we found out about this alleged conversation occurs with the backdrop of that, obviously.
And I would just add that I think in league circles, the idea that the Kraft-Belichick relationship was functional on anything other than a strictly professional and wins-losses level, you know, is not news in league circles. Like, you know, I reported in my book that in 2008, so that's after Belichick had the Patriots 30 seconds from an undefeated season, and the season where Spygate happened, and Kraft obviously, you know, did what he could to petition the league to, and successfully did so, to give them an easy punishment or a light punishment, after 7 years of breaking the rules, you know, at a league meeting in that spring, Kraft was in a meeting, an executive asked him, you know, what's it going to take for you to fire that asshole? And Kraft goes 8-8. And that was 30 seconds away from a 19-0 season. And so I think that Kraft in the documentary, you know, looked into the camera and confirmed a lot of reporting from myself and others that he spent years denying. And he was very blunt, and we quoted it in the story where he said, you know, my coach was a pain, and that I was willing to put up with it as long as we're winning. And it's funny how narratives work, because the past 2 years, as the Patriots have been completely inept on offense, and as Mac Jones has gone from looking like the best rookie out of that class, which he was his first year, to, you know, wondering if he was going to have a job come this offseason. The narrative was that the game has passed Bill by. He no longer has his fastball. Look at this. They can't do this without Tom Brady. The thing is falling apart. It was all Tom, blah, blah, blah. Then we have this crazy week in January where Bill all of a sudden finds himself without a job, even though he wanted one. And then you have this docuseries, which just takes aim at him and, you know, glosses over some of the most brilliant game plans in NFL history and the biggest lever, you know, the highest leverage moments. And now all of a sudden, I think people are turning around a little bit and saying, like, how is it again that this guy doesn't have a job? How is it that somebody who has 8 Super Bowl rings somehow is going to be doing television this fall and writing a book? Now, we will see next year whether that's a narrative among executives and us and players and even some coaches, or whether it's a narrative with the people who matter, which is the owners.
You know, it's so interesting just to share from my view at the Packers. He was the only coach general manager in the league at that time. And there was a year where Ron Wolf, my mentor, retired, and he basically gave the job to our coach, who was a young aspiring coach named Mike Sherman. And Mike was the other coach general manager in the NFL at that 3-year period until we hired Ted Thompson. So it was an interesting dynamic to see that. Now, Mike was a nice guy, is a nice guy. And Mike would come to me all the time, guys, and say, Andrew, I got to make you the bad guy here. I just got to. I have to. And I say, completely understand. Totally understand. Because as you guys know, a coach has to motivate, has to inspire, has to get guys to run through a brick wall. And a general manager has to be forward focused, detached emotionally, and willing to move on from a player at a drop of a hat. That is a hard combination. And we used to talk amongst executives around the league. It's like, yeah, Belichick's the only guy who can do that because he's, what's the word? Kind of a jerk. You know, like, you have to be that to do that job. You have to not care what players think of you. And it was always amazing to me that he actually did that job where he controlled the purse strings while trying to motivate. So hard to do.
It's so hard to do. And he's one of the few people, I think, as an evaluator of talent, coming, you know, draft talent, he's average, right? I think that, like, there are guys in Green Bay, in Seattle, Philly, you know, who I think are probably better. I think that he has always been phenomenal when it comes to free agency trades and finding ways to get people to take hometown discounts, even though they're coming to New England.
Right.
And there aren't very many coaches who have the salary cap knowledge to be able to do that. Like, I'm not sure that Mike Sherman did, no offense to Mike. Yeah. I don't think he was steeped in every loophole in the salary cap. And so there's very few guys who could do that. And I think one of the reasons why he liked that system was not only because, you know, he admired Bill Walsh, not only because he saw how hard it was for Parcells at times when he didn't have it, but because it eliminates an appeals court.
Yeah.
And, you know, but this time around, he was willing to say, I just want a coach. Like, I'll work with the existing, you know, the existing infrastructure. You know, there will be an appeals court. I'm willing to do that. And, you know, for the one team that took a hard look at him, you know, it was unappealing. And for the, you know, 6 or so other teams that you thought maybe might take a look at him, it wasn't even worth a phone call.
And one of the things that I want to point out, Andrew, that was so interesting to me in the reporting of this is Arthur Blank was going to have to trust Bill Belichick at his and take him at his word that he was not going to be Bill Belichick. Right? There's only one Bill Belichick that anybody knows.
Right.
And Bill Belichick went into there to the super yacht meeting and presumably again with that second meeting with the other Falcons executives and assured them he was not going to be the guy he's been for almost his entire career, certainly the last most of the 24 years in New England. And so in our reporting, we have this where we have no doubt that there was a statement made by Robert Kraft that you can't trust Bill Belichick. Well, Arthur Blank was going to have to trust Bill Belichick and take him at his word that he was going to be a different kind of head coach. And, you know, as our story points out, is Belichick even capable of that? And I think that's another thing going against him in this next offseason is can Belichick be somebody who he's never been before? Does he even know how to do it?
No, your reporting is that in the final meeting with the Falcons brass, they came up with a top three, Raheem Morris, Mike McDonald, and Bobby Slowick. Let me ask you something. Is Bill Belichick reading that for the first time? Does he know he came in below the top three in Atlanta? Did he know?
I don't think he knew.
Yeah.
Until we reported it and we had, you know, due diligence as reporters reaching out to, you know, essential parties, you know, I don't think that he knew that.
Yeah, I don't think he did either. And we had multiple sources that told us that. And he wasn't in the top three of any of the executives, including Blank.
Wow.
Yeah.
And as for these other teams, I mean, you reported that LA was always on Harbaugh.
Yeah.
But pick a team. The Carolina or Washington or I mean, were these teams even reaching out to Neil Kornrich, the agent who I dealt with many times in my career? Was Neil reaching out to them? Was there just radio silence? Is it no contact whatsoever? Not even a thought?
Well, there was a lot of contact. I mean, but again, he never got to an interview with anybody else. Like we're analyzing the Falcons process, but it's only because it's the only process to look at.
Yeah.
And I think that the one that surprised me the most, I think looking back on it, was Washington.
Yeah.
Because, you know, again, hometown ties, jumpstart for a franchise that really needs it. You know, there's business elements that he could help with. And, you know, he talked to Adam Peters, who, you know, was from he got his start in the NFL in New England, in the scouting department there, and went on to, you know, help teams get to Super Bowls and help one of them win them. And, you know, I think it was a respectful conversation where, you know, mutual admiration was expressed, but it was not a job interview. And the moment that Josh Harris, and we report that he decided in December, and Robert Kraft talked to him also, that he was not going to hire Bill. He wanted his, you know, the Commanders to reflect some of his other teams, which was a strong GM, and the head coach reports into the GM. It was a big tell that Bill wasn't going to end up there. And, you know, sure enough, there was not an interview.
Yeah, and you almost thought, Andrew, that it was the Commanders were going to do what Jerry Jones did when he hired Parcells. Remember, he hired Parcells in large part because he needed him to get AT&T Stadium, to get the financing for it. And Jerry was pretty open about that at the time, that was the play. And you thought the similar thing would happen in Washington because they're desperate for a new stadium. They'd prefer to have it in the district. And so Belichick is, you know, clearly the person that can help you get there if you're looking at it beyond the football decision, but just as a, you know, rehabilitate the franchise decision. So, and then you have Magic Johnson pushing very hard as well, as we report. And yet Josh Harris, as Seth just said, even before the starting gates open with this, you know, in January, decides. And by the way, after a conversation with Robert Kraft, now we don't know what was said in that conversation the way we do with what was said in the conversations with Arthur Blank, but after a conversation with Robert Kraft, Josh Harris decides, no, we're not going to hire Bill.
I think, like you guys hinted, as we wind this down, I was more surprised, I guess, beyond Atlanta, on three teams that didn't make changes to get Bill Belichick and stayed with what they have. As you mentioned, the Cowboys, I guess two really, Cowboys and Eagles, because both had really disappointing ends. Both had really frustrating conclusions to their season. I mean, the Eagles were on a downward slide most of the last half of the season, and the Cowboys had the ridiculously lopsided game against the Packers. Jerry Jones, we all think, is very emotional, and as you know, Don, very prone to emotion. He didn't change.
And it's surprising because Jerry Jones is has a lot of affection, a very high regard for Bill Belichick going back to the 1990s. They're very close. Stephen Jones is very close with Belichick as well. And so it was surprising at how quickly after the Cowboys got demolished by the seventh seed Packers on their home field in that wild card game that Jerry decided to stick with Mike McCarthy for one final season in Dallas. And clearly McCarthy's a lame duck coach. And if the Cowboys can't get to the NFC title game or a Super Bowl, he'll be out the door. And the question will be whether Belichick is the person that Jerry calls. I mean, he is a sort of plug-and-play coach for somebody with very little patience like Jerry Jones has and wants to win immediately. So it'll be very surprising if Belichick is available and McCarthy's out the door at the end of the next season if he doesn't end up with the Cowboys, despite Jerry's aversion for, strong coaches and everything else. There's just too much of a high regard there that Jerry has for Belichick.
Yeah, it turns out the cutthroat NFL isn't nearly as cutthroat as it likes to think it is.
That's right.
Because what do you want? Do you want the guy with eight rings? What do you actually want? And
is it a meritocracy too, right? That's the other question that I kept thinking about during this thing. And there's seven openings. And is it a meritocracy or not? Or is it all the baggage that's perceived to come with Belichick just too much? And the other thing too is age. You raised that very smart question earlier, Andrew, about ageism. It's so striking that Raheem Morris, you know, deserves a chance. He blew them away, blew the Falcons away in the interview. We report that. We should make it clear. He's 47 years old. There's a quarter of a century separating him and Belichick. Raheem Morris is much, much closer in age to his players than Belichick would have been. And I think that's a factor that can't be discounted either.
You know, Seth, you talked briefly about the Eagles. I'm outside of Philadelphia. In fact, Howie Roseman is probably a mile this way where he lives. I remember Howie when he was banished from the building when Chip Kelly was there. And he kind of spent a year studying leadership and studying ways to run a franchise and using that as almost a sabbatical, and obviously came back to great success. I remember the one of the guys he studied was Bill Belichick and sat with him while working for the Eagles, but kind of sent off to purgatory while Kelly ran things. So that one surprised me a little too. But of course, they didn't feel like they could fire a Super Bowl coach 13 months ago. Nick Sirianni.
I mean, lost a Super Bowl at the buzzer.
Yeah.
And, it was won 36 games in 3 years.
Yeah.
Which is a heck of a resume, but it's not Bill Belichick's resume. And, Howie and Belichick have become friends over the years. And I think that, they have different salary cap philosophies, but I think game respects game. And, it's interesting that you added that. Note about how Howie wanted to return to the Eagles a different person than he was when Chip booted him, because Chip, of course, is one of Belichick's really good friends too. And they stole a lot of Chip's ideas, with the Patriots, running his blur offense at times and things like that. So it's a fascinating league. And it'll be interesting to see next December. Does Belichick serve as a kind of accelerator of sorts? Someone who, forces teams to move on from their coaches before the regular season ends so that they can get the first dibs at him? Or is it similar to this year where depending on who the coach, you know, depending what openings open, you know, are they interested in him or not? Like, what culture do they want? What system do they want? What level of winning do they want? And that's going to be a really fascinating push and pull, because he'll be 73 years old at week one of the 2025 season.
Yeah. And as we report, Andrew, Belichick's sort of wish list after this upcoming season is really the NFC East. It's the Eagles, the Giants, or the Cowboys. So he's optimistic he'll get at least one interview, we reported. But somebody who's very close to him, a confidant, is questioning whether Belichick will ever coach again. And we have that quote in our story, with the exception of Jerry Jones and the Cowboys. This person who's very close to Bill believes that the best shot, maybe the last shot, is with Jerry Jones, just because of the relationship, because of that plug and play aspect. And if Jerry doesn't get out of the wild card round or pass the divisional round, the desperation will set in. That clock is ticking louder and louder every year. And, you know, we know how desperate Jerry is to win a Super Bowl for the first time in nearly three decades. And so Belichick will be there and ready.
I was going to do the, it's been reported, the ESPN with Pat McAfee on the draft extravaganza. Maybe I missed it. Are there any media plans for Belichick right now past the draft?
Yes. So we report in our story, what our sources have told us is that Belichick is about to sign with Omaha Productions, a TV deal.
So would that be the Monday night? Would he come on the Monday night telecast, or would it just be wherever they...
I don't know the exact details of it, Seth. You might. I believe it's a Manning cast type of play that they will use him on. But I think that's going to be announced shortly here. So we'll find out the details, I think, pretty soon.
I think the answer is whatever Bill wants.
Yeah. That's true. That's right. He'll get what he wants from the TV on the TV side. Not what he could get from Arthur Blank and the other teams. It's kind of ironic, isn't it?
I do wonder if, I mean, some of these coaches got to be smart enough, and I say smart enough, and this is the whole whether you can bring him in on a part-time basis, you know, to use his knowledge as a consultant, or bring him to training camp for 2 weeks or a week, or have him work with the defensive backs at some camp for three days. I would think somebody would do something like that.
Yeah, I raised that to people who talk to Bill frequently, and I didn't get the sense that's something he wants.
Okay.
He's, as I said earlier, he wants that record. He wants to break Don Shula's record. 15 wins is all he needs to do it. He's got his eye on that ball, and he wants it so desperately that he was willing to tell the Falcons whatever they wanted to hear. I'll just be a head coach. I don't need to make any of these decisions again. And so that wasn't good enough. And I'd be surprised if he doesn't say similar things this next offseason with whoever grants him an interview.
But you talk about what he wants. Seth, you know him. I mean, I don't see this guy working on his handicap all year or lying on a beach. You know, what's he going to do?
I suspect he'll do some travel.
Yeah,
but I think that this is the first offseason that he hasn't been on an NFL team since 1974 when he was at Wesleyan. So these are the rhythms and frequencies of his entire adult life. And I don't see a lot of that changing. And I think that, you know, remember Mike Shanahan when he was let go by Denver and he had a gap year there before he started in Washington. You use it to try to shore up your holes. And I think that, you know, Belichick is such a fascinating character in American culture and in sports culture, but, like, you know, he is a ruthless self-evaluator. And I think that he will look hard at, like, and it has already looked hard at what things led to the slide in New England and why he's in this position of starting over. And I do think that one of them, and we touched on this earlier, is that he felt like that he lost too many key lieutenants in New England. Mm. And it was, you know, it's like Mac Jones was a terrific player under Josh McDaniels, and he just kept getting worse and worse over the, you know, in the last couple of years. And I do think that that's one of the reasons why wherever he goes, you know, he wants to bring these broken toys with him.
And the question is, will an owner let him do that?
Yeah.
Right. Is that too much of a black mark, too much of a hurdle for Belichick to overcome? Is even with concessions, he still has certain tools he feels he needs to be a success. And will an owner let him do that? That's what we'll find out next offseason.
Well, I opened the podcast asking you if you're surprised he's not coaching in 2024. Will you be surprised if he's not coaching in 2025? And where do you think he will? I mean, we've talked about a couple of places.
Well, I'll be surprised if they're on his NFC East wish list, if there's at least two openings. I'm gonna hedge a little bit, Andrew. If there's at least two of those three teams with openings, let's just hypothetically say it's the Giants and the Cowboys, and he doesn't get either of those jobs, I'll be very surprised. If there's only one, if it's Jerry Jones, I'd bet a little bit of money on him being there.
Yeah.
I mean, as this person who's very close to him has said, after what he witnessed in the in this particular offseason, there's a question of whether he'll ever coach again. Seth, what do you think?
Well, I want to clarify one thing you said. Don theoretically would bet.
Yes, that's right. I would theoretically bet.
We're not placing bets on anything.
That's right. But, that's right. There's no NFL bets for Seth and me. That's exactly
right. No, anywhere close. But I my gut tells me that he'll have a narrow pool in 2025. I think that one team will pick him. I do think that he'll end up on a sideline. But, you know, if it doesn't happen, you know, we can't say we weren't warned. And you know this as well as anybody. You know, owners are interesting because in one sense, they are all, you know, their own, you know, bosses of their own world and universe. But they tend to kind of go with groupthink. Like, there are very few NFL votes that come down to a vote or two. Most of them are like 31-0, and it's only because Mike Brown won't vote on anything. And so
I witnessed a lot of those. Yeah.
Yes, groupthink sets in, and groupthink is setting in right now on Belichick and, you know, what's been known for two decades as the Patriot way.
And I got to ask, and this has kind of been a theme we've talked about, how much of that groupthink is influenced by Kraft?
That's a terrific question. It's hard to quantify it, but certainly the last few months have not been kind to Belichick in the portrait of him, certainly in the docuseries. And, you know, Stacey James insists that Kraft had no editorial control over that docuseries that he supported. And that, you know, let's be honest, that docuseries is Robert Kraft's ticket, he hopes, to the Hall of Fame, which is something he desperately wants, a bronze bust of his in Canton. So that was a big part of what that play was. But yeah, there are owners that are looking carefully at the last 4 years, the 29-39 record of the Patriots, the busted draft picks, particularly a quarterback. Belichick's demeanor is part of it. You know, he's not warm and fuzzy is the assessment that's made. And as I said earlier, I think the trend in the league is for cooperation and collaboration. And that's not his reputation. And again, I think it comes down to he's going to continue to try to make assurances to owners that he can change.
Yeah.
Can a 72-year-old coach who has won six Super Bowls doing it one way, can he now do it a different way? And an owner's going to have to make that bet, speaking of a bet, if they hire him and do it in a very short window, because he has a short window. He wants to set that record and he's going to ride off into the sunset. So it's going to be very interesting to see. But to answer your question, Andrew, it's a great one of how much has Robert Kraft and in some ways the media in the way we understand who Bill Belichick is, how much of that harms his chances of getting one more job is what we'll find out. But I certainly think a lot of the Kraft view of him, and we had a quote in our story from somebody very close to Kraft who just said that Bill is, in the view of Robert Kraft, very, very arrogant. and obstinate. And these are words that you don't want thrown around. If you're seeking a job, no matter who you are, you don't want those jobs, you don't want those words attached to you as you're trying to tell an owner, hey, I can change. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what'll happen. But certainly Kraft's view and the falling out that they had, that we all know so much about, a lot of it from Seth through his great book, is certainly hurting Belichick's chances and limiting his chances going forward. There's no doubt about that. Yeah.
In voted off the island inside Bill Belichick's failed job hunt. What a great piece. Find it on ESPN.com. Don Vanetta, Seth Wickersham, great work as always. Stellar, excellent work as you always do. And thanks for coming on the pod. This was a great, wide-ranging discussion, a lot of topics. Great to get this in. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, man.
Thank you, Andrew. Great to see you.
Thanks so much. What a great conversation. Great to have those guys on, talk about the inside business with Bill Belichick and not getting a job and how it went and what really happened. And their reporting is always spot on. I mean, they're talking to the top of the top in terms of people around the league, people they can trust, people you can trust reading. So I thought I'd bring them on. Always find my stuff. You can go to my newsletter, my daily doses at the Sports Business League, sportsbusinessleague.com. My Instagram has these reels at Andrew Brandt too. Of course, Twitter, Andrew Brandt. And of course, please leave us a rating, give us a review. We always enjoy it. Hope you find this unique. Hope you share this podcast with a friend. Please do. Thanks to Jack Connell, my producer, Sam Brandt, my musical producer. Thanks to you for listening. I'll be back next week with another edition of The Business of Sports with Andrew Brandt.